This is really the kind of movie that the people who made Perry Mason should have been looking at to begin with. And so that's from 1933, The Mystery of the Wax Museum, and it is from Warner Archives, a new print that has been reconstructed by the UCLA Archive of Television and Movies. And so that's my pick for today. We'll get back to DK.
Thank you, Matthew. Great stuff. And that's it for this week's Film at 11. We'll be back next week with some more surprises and more guests. So until then, keep watching the screens.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series where we get to profile some of the amazing recordings in our 55,000 program collection going back to 1949. I'm your host, Mark Torres. On this week's From the Vault, we examine the politicization of immigration and labor from a 1982 roundtable forum. And then we'll look how in March of 2017, the Trump administration immigration policies are impacting our current immigrant communities and what we can do about it. With Loyola Law School's Immigrant Justice Clinic co-director Marissa Montes and Alejandro Barajas, staff attorney at the same clinic. But first we begin by looking back at how immigrants and undocumented laborers were perceived in 1982 during the Ronald Reagan presidency. Pacifica Radio KPFA producer Richard Gonzalez gathered a diverse panel of experts to discuss the many topics of the immigrant workforce. The panel included Armando Valdez, then the director of the Center for Chicano Research at Stanford University, Joaquin Avila, president and lead counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, or MALDEF, Elizabeth Martinez, known affectionately as Petita Martinez to the fans of her book 400 Years of Chicano History in Pictures, and Ignacio de la Fuente of the International Molders and Allied Workers Union, Local 164. Together they survey the history, bust the myths, and make sense of the outrage when the subject turns to undocumented workers. Here is Pacifica Station KPFA's 1982 Immigration and Labor Roundtable Discussion, produced by Richard Gonzalez.
Voy a contarles, señores, voy a contarles, señores, todo lo que yo sufrí. Desde que dejé mi patria, desde que dejé mi patria, por venir a este país.
In the words of this popular Mexican corrido, an immigrant offers to tell the audience of all of the suffering he experienced upon leaving his country to come to the United States. Hello, I'm Richard Gonzalez, and for the next hour, you'll hear a panel discussion on immigration and labor. Much of what we hear from the mass media focuses on the alleged threat posed by waves of undesirable immigrants, the illegal alien who robs American citizens of employment. Solutions to the controversy are discussed in the most restrictive terms. Laws are proposed to criminalize the pursuit of employment, while public debate centers on resolving the so-called problem once and for all. Our panel will discuss other aspects of the immigration controversy. How the term illegal alien appeals to the prejudices of the American working class, how the border is open for capital to flow back and forth, but is closed to labor, how organized labor perceives the threat of an unorganized, easily manipulated labor force, and what can be done to broaden the public perception of the interaction between immigration and labor. Our panel includes Joaquin Avila, President and General Counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, or MALDEF, Elizabeth Martinez, former editor of El Grito del Norte and author of 400 Years of Chicano History. She is currently a candidate for governor of California on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. Ignacio de la Fuente is a business representative of the International Molders and Allied Workers Union, Local 164. Our moderator was the former publisher of El Calendario Chicano and is currently associate director of the Center for Chicano Research at Stanford University, Armando Valdez.
I was able to prepare myself by looking at a lot of documents that we have, papers and so forth, as well as talking to a number of colleagues. And I came across a very startling, to me, fact, and that is that immigration from Mexico to this country really peaked in the 1930s. That came as something new to me. Of course, I wasn't born quite then, I thought that, you know, given what I have experienced in my life, I thought that we had massive waves of immigration in the 50s, again, mid to late 60s, and certainly we hear a lot in the media currently about immigration, particularly the undocumented work of the illegal immigrant. Also, what I learned is that if you look at the estimates of the number of immigrants, particularly the illegal immigrants, they range anywhere from, I believe INS during the Nixon years estimated 8 million annual immigrants coming into this country. The Census Bureau, of course, realized that that was really fallacious and went back and did some other studies, and they came up with a figure of 2 to 3 million and so forth. I think the empirical facts and numbers are not as important as what it means to us as Chicanos and Latinos, as well as what it means to other non-Latinos in this country. The issues and the terms, immigration, gives you an outsider status. Beyond that, the term illegal gives you a political legal status as well. I'd like to now turn to a discussion about some of those terms, some of the symbolic and emotional value in these terms. I'd like to ask Elizabeth, first of all, to react to that, and then we'll just move around the table and comment on her comments.
Well, two thoughts about that. First of all, I know that during the Depression, when there were massive deportations of Mexicanos going on, and there was an effort to divide those who were born here, who were, citizens, and those who were not, who were from Mexico, to divide them by, cultivating negative attitudes, one from the other, including the terminology. And I don't remember all of it then, but I know there was pocho and mocho and cholo, and I mean there was a whole range of words that were used that were one calling the other, a term became symbolic of these divisions, which were encouraged. It is not that people grew up hating each other or distrusting each other, but they were divisions that were encouraged by, by the corporate powers that employed both. Who were both, after all, workers creating wealth for other people. But to keep them from uniting was very important, and that still, of course, is very true today. The other thing I would say is that this whole concept of legal and illegal, I think, is enormously important because, of course, it is precisely that concept which makes it possible to keep down the workers, the undocumented workers, because it makes it possible to control them. In other words, if someone is deportable because of the lack of a piece of paper, which thereby makes them, quote, illegal, they are incredibly vulnerable to exploitation, to any kind of control. The law is used that way.
Speaking of the law, I'd like to turn over to Joaquin and to Ignacio and begin exploring some of these issues a little further. The terms documented and undocumented workers seem to have replaced particularly the term of illegal immigrant. I'd like you to comment on that and talk about the significant symbolic value of those terms.
Well, it's more than just a apart from a symbolic term. There is some, I think, legal significance to that. First of all, to say that someone is illegal means that the person has been determined to be illegal according to our law, that the person does not have a legal right to be in this country. And such a determination doesn't happen until there is a final ruling by a federal court and by any other applicable state court. So, when you have a person and you have the term used, illegal alien, it's really a poor choice of words. It is inaccurate. Legally, it is inaccurate. In terms of the symbolic difference, it's a very important difference in my estimation, because first of all, we have to, I guess, reemphasize the fact that this part of the country was at once belonged to Mexico. And to say that persons who are eventually part of this country because of their affiliation with Mexico, to call them illegal is, again, not a reflection, an accurate reflection of reality. So the distinction, I think, is it's important, not only from a legal point of view, but also from a symbolic point of view. And it's a distinction that has been used historically. And you look at immigration historically, you see that whenever there is an economic prosperity, you go back at the prior to World War I, during the 20s, 1930s, in World War II, you find that the U.S., along with agribusiness and corporate interests, actively sought and promoted Hispanic migration from Mexico. And it's only after the World War I terminated that there was a mass deportation of Hispanics into Mexico, again with the deportations of the 30s, and once again with the deportations in the 50s with Operation Wetback. And now, with the present economic recession, we have the same thing occurring. And it's very important to recognize that immigration is a historical event that has, it's like a cycle that keeps recurring. And it is not just limited to Hispanics. You look at the Asians, their experiences here in this country. You look at the dark-skinned Europeans and the efforts by Congress to limit their migration to this country in the early 1900s. So you have to see it in the context of history, and you have to see it in the context of not only the economic cycle and what all of that means, but also in the social context.
It's so important what Joaquin just said about what happened in the 1920s and 1930s. The economy of this country was booming. They needed workers, no matter at that time, illegal or legal, or they didn't care the status of those people at that time. They needed the people to work, and they were actually seeking Mexicans who come across the border to work, especially in farming. It's so obvious that only when we in the Depression is when they actually put more attention on how many undocumented or how many people we can deport or how many people we don't need anymore that we already used for many years. And now is the time to send them back. It's only during those bad economic times when they actually tried to enforce laws that have been in the books for many, many years. I think the history of labor has been that labor represents workers. And I don't know of any union that has, for example, and I'm talking about that because I represent union, any type of distinction between workers, or if you documented or undocumented. Is nothing in any union that I know that distinguish between undocumented and undocumented worker in this country. We represent workers, and union responsibilities represent workers. So the connection between what's happening in this country economically, politically, and during this type of depressed times, when this type of actions by the government is taken against certain class of people in this country, is what make us actually really see, okay, what is all about the loss of this country, what the things that's got to be changed, why we facing the problems that we're facing at this time.
One of the things that's emerging is that in the conversation here is the fact that the border itself is you know, revolving door, revolving gate. There are times, for economic and other reasons, that this country finds it favorable to have an infusion of extra workers and other citizens, and at that point, there is no problem whatsoever. At other times, of course, there is a need for people to leave, and of course, you have these different things. Operation Wetback was in 1952, and 30 years later, 1982, we had Operation Jobs. Nonetheless, different terms, different rhetoric. As Ignacio points out, however, the fundamental condition is the same. One of the things that this points out, it seems to me, and I'd like you to react to it, is that in fact what we're talking about is immigrants themselves being scapegoats, being used to the benefit of certain interests in this country, and also the fact that they would be vulnerable given the terms, particularly undocumented, legal, etc. I'd like you to react to that and what it might mean in terms of current public opinion, the public mood in this country. You know, auto workers, unionized workers being out of jobs. And nonetheless, the rhetoric and public opinion polls seem to show that people believe that, you know, they're losing jobs because of the immigrants.
Just to back up a minute, because on this whole question of illegal, before we just go ahead about that, because I do feel strongly about that. I think, I mean, formally speaking, you know, on the books or whatever, there may be such a thing. But I think it's crucial that we understand that the border really is a legal fiction. I didn't say it was an illegal fiction, but I say it's a legal fiction. Look, what reality does that border have for capital, right, for big business? It goes back and forth across the border at will. The maquiladoras get put on one side of the border and the workers come to the other side. I mean, it goes everywhere. General Motors, we were talking about earlier, is right in Mexico, along with Volkswagen, along with, you know, you name it. The Fortune 500 practically is in Mexico. This capital goes back and forth. And yet, workers become somehow illegal when they go back and forth. But I think it's important that we see that the border is really a legal fiction which facilitates the exploitation of those workers. It's used that way against them. And I just wanted to say that because I think if we don't start from that perspective, which is a perspective, I think, of justice and of standing up for those workers, and then fight it, you know, down the line from there, that we're starting from a misconception, because really, no hay frontera for big business.
Well, I would just like to point out, even though it's a legal fiction, it's still there, and we have to deal with it. And the best way of dealing with it is to try to figure out what the politically, what can be done in terms of trying to minimize any further exploitation of workers, at the same time trying to make sure that there are no further erosions of Hispanic citizens' rights. And it may be a fiction, but nevertheless, it's a very real fiction.
The sociologists use a term that they call the self-fulfilling prophecy, and even though it's a myth, you label it as such and repeat it so often that people react to the myth, irrespective of whether there's any substance to it, and I think that's a very important point. I'd like some of you to react to your impressions of mass media coverage about immigration in relationship to the problems that we've been talking about.
Definitely, Armando. I think that we saw a tremendous media coverage on the INS raids during the month of April, especially. Was so obvious, okay? Again, I'm using that word because to me was so obvious the role that the media was playing, especially in that type of situation. It's no question about it. What you mentioned before, that when this country needs labor, or when they need bodies to work, is you don't hear of this type of raids. You don't hear of people being deported. You don't turn on the TV like you did during the last couple of weeks of April, and everything you saw during that time was workers taken away from factories. You don't see nothing like that, because it's not in the interest of the people that are using those people. One of the biggest things that was obvious to me is that we're facing almost a 10% unemployment in this country. We have over 10 million people out of work in this country. Nobody in his right mind will believe that appointing certain numbers, 1,000, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 workers, because they are legal or illegal, anyway you want to call them, or undocumented, will resolve the problem that we're facing at this time of 10% unemployment. It was actually stated not only by the actual people they deported, but it was actually expressed by owners of businesses that there was a waste of money, there was a waste of time, there was a waste of effort from the INS agency, because some of the people that they deported was back within a few days or within a few weeks. Okay, it's no question about the situation those people are facing. They raided the factories that we represent. They raided some foundries. They raided some poultry business. They raided some mushroom plants. And those owners of those businesses can tell you that they were waiting for those people to return because it was not people available to actually perform that low-paying job and hard job to perform. Like, the media make it sound like it was thousands and hundreds of people waiting for those jobs. They might be to put applications for those jobs, but they only lasted a day or two because they had hard jobs to do. They had many hours of work. It's cheap labor. There's no question about it.
Well, let's talk about the kind of jobs, first of all, that the immigrant, and both legal and illegal, or documented and undocumented, are found in this country. And I think that'll give us a little bit more substance to the comments that we're making here, and that is that there is no direct competition, or that certainly the immigrant is not the cause of the current economic decline and the loss of jobs or other workers. What has been your experiences, and what have you observed, or what are your impressions on that? Let's start with you, Alyssa.
Well, I know from living quite a few years in New Mexico, which is not as much of a center of immigration as, say, California, but still many workers come in from the northern states of Mexico. Mm-hmm. The kinds of jobs they got were really, you know, at the bottom when they could get them, and agriculture and sort of, you know, whatever kind of labor was around. And then I think we saw very clearly at the time of the recent raids what sort of jobs were suddenly available. Wonderful jobs, 12 hours a day in total darkness, taking care of mushrooms in a damp, humid room, you know, wearing a light on your head like a miner, at $5.25 an hour. Jobs that over and over again the employers would say, I can't get people. They won't, I mean, to take those jobs. That's not true of every single job, but the over and over again, that was the kind of job you heard about being suddenly available by this so-called totally falsely labeled Operation Jobs.
Well, just following up on that, it is a scapegoat. I mean, you look at, when you're looking for scapegoats, you look at a group of persons who are the least protected, persons who do not have any rights or any means of protecting themselves. So the natural target is the undocumented population. Apart from that being morally wrong, the implications of that are significant, because in order for them to determine who is undocumented and who is documented, they have to look at, and who are they going to stop? People that don't look American, people without blue eyes, blonde hair, people in the Southwest, that will be most of your Hispanics and some of your Asians. Those are the people that are going to suffer some of the ripple effects of the current scapegoating. It's just not the undocumented population that's going to be affected. It is an overall problem. It's tied in to racism. It's tied in to discrimination by employers. It's tied in to perceptions by the Anglo society of the Hispanic population. It serves as a very convenient scapegoat, and we have to recognize it as such, and we have to fight it whenever we're confronted with it.
You are listening to the Pacifica 1982 panel discussion on immigration and labor on From the Vault. Elizabeth Batita Martinez.
One of the great myths, I think, that we have been fed by the media coverage and elsewhere is that that there's this great desire from the rulers of this society to not have these workers come in. In other words, how do you shut the border? Which everybody, you know, INS says is impossible. But anyway, how do you stop these, quote, hordes, you know, particularly of Mexicans, but also Central Americans and Caribbean people? In fact, this is a great lie, because in fact they want a certain percentage of those workers to get in, to come. And I think we have to start by recognizing that. And I would like to just speak to that a little bit, because I think that the analysis that, you know, we have been working on in the Democratic Workers Party is sees immigration policy today as a little different from the revolving door concept of the 30s and of the 50s that have been mentioned here. And that's because the economic crisis in the United States today, which is a worldwide crisis really, is like a very serious and very deep and very structural crisis in which we see things like steel and auto and other major industries unable to compete with Japan, Western Europe, and so forth, trying to get back their profit ratios, trying to become competitive again. This is the situation of domestic industry in this country. So how does it go about becoming competitive again, finding new ways to keep up the profit ratio? One of the main solutions it looks to is, guess who? The undocumented workers that we're talking about right here today. And what I'm saying is that maintaining a certain portion of the labor force at rock bottom, totally cheap labor, totally controllable by virtue of deportation, the legal thing we talked about earlier, plugging them in to the worst kinds of jobs, and with an increasing use of women, of Mexicanas, in sweatshops, in putting out forms of labor that go back to the 19th century, you know, that this is the one of the major solutions for this crisis today. Therefore, I don't think it's just another revolving door that here's a crisis and so out with the workers. It isn't really, because they want a certain portion of them. Under Carter and under Reagan, it became very clear that what was really wanted was a sort of institutionalized cheap labor force, which we have called a transnational labor force, because it goes back and forth across those borders. And that we need to understand this. It isn't that they want, some right-wingers may say, oh, you know, get them out of here. But in fact, the real, you know, real big business interests don't want that. They want a controllable, cheap labor force. So it's a somewhat different situation, and that's because of the nature of the crisis, which is the worst economic crisis in 40 years.
Joaquin Avila.
I think that's a very important point. I think it's reflected by the current crisis that Mexico is having and its effect on the border cities in the U.S. with respect to American businesses. If you remove the so-called undocumented population from this country, you will have business failures, you will have a severe economic crisis, not only in the barrio areas, but also with major industries which rely on the undocumented population as a cheap source of labor. And it's very important for the United States, for the government, for the federal government to recognize that. They only do it when it's convenient. And when the picture changes and it needs some scapegoats, they change the rules, they change the immigration laws, and they deport these people.
One of the implications in what you've just said, Elizabeth, is that in fact the border is an open border for the convenience of, you know, capital and corporate interests. I wonder if all of you on the panel concur with that.
Well, dealing with, as I mentioned earlier, even though it's characterized as legal fiction, and in many instances it is. I mean, you look at geographically, culturally, the people. There's no reason why one would have a natural border, an international border there. But nevertheless, there is a border there. And in terms of trying to formulate a position for immigration, we as an organization have not taken the position that we're advocating open borders. Primarily, our focus has been on making sure that we're able to curb the Gestapo-like tactics of the INS. And what that means is curbing and restraining their efforts in stopping people with no basis whatsoever. And what that means for us in terms of open borders is that we feel, as an organization, that the efforts of the immigration officers should be focused primarily at the borders. International law recognizes that a country has a right to expel persons, to keep people out. That's something that's very difficult to go against if we're in a legal forum. And so for that reason, in terms of trying to examine the practical realities. And I think we have to look at it in terms of where we're trying to minimize our losses in this situation. We feel that we cannot really justify legally that we should have just an open border. And for that reason, we focus most of our arguments, most of our resources, on making sure that we're able to curb the abuses of the INS officials and trying to limit their activities.
Ignacio, do you feel that the labor movement really does support the notion of an open border, or do they in fact historically see the immigrant as a cheap pool of surplus labor that in fact does serve to depress the wages and also works against a variety of worker gains and concessions and rights they have in this country?
Ignacio de la Fuente.
Well, I think that historically, yes. Historically, I think that the labor unions in general have treated the problem the way you express. I think that the situation is changing, though. I think that labor unions are facing not only direct attacks from not only from this administration, but from every administration within the last 20 years. Labor unions are losing ground, even though some labor leaders don't like to admit that, that they do on losing ground, but they are losing ground. The labor movement is losing members, organized members, during the last 5 or 10 years. And one of the reasons is because it's more sophisticated attacks put out by corporations, by multinational corporations against unions. Another area is that unions have, again, for the last 10 or 20 years, been, should I say, asleep, okay? They've been in a stage of suspended animation, you want to say that, okay? They haven't actually looked at the situation the way that you should be looking at the situation now. One of the reasons I'm saying that the labor unions are looking at the situation, especially what we're talking about, the immigration problem in a different way, is because unions losing tremendous amount of ground, losing tremendous amount of membership. For example, we're talking about a Los Angeles area. You have a tremendous amount of Mexican labor in Los Angeles area. Most of those people are unorganized workers. One of the reasons they are unorganized workers is because the employer has, what Elizabeth was talking about a little while ago, the power to control those people. They have, first, the threat of being deported in case that they dare to talk about a unionist shop. They making considerably less than what people is making in these areas. So they have actually controlled a tremendous amount of workforce, especially in the state of California.
You have been listening to Pacifica Radio's 1982 recording of a roundtable discussion on immigration and labor. This is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive's original weekly series. To get a copy of this program, go to pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. Next, we turn to a conversation I had with Marisa Montes and Alejandro Barajas of the Loyola Law School's Immigrant Justice Clinic. Marisa Montes is the co-director of the clinic, and Alejandro Barajas is one of their staff attorneys. Let's get into this conversation to discover some of the current challenges to our immigrant communities. Here we are, March 23rd, 2017. Where do we stand with Trump's current executive orders on immigration?
Trump has signed officially 3 executive orders: the border security, enhancing public safety, and protecting nations from terrorists. So in regards to his border security measure, or executive order, it basically orders the construction of the border wall. But what most people don't know is that there's already a substantial border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So building a bigger wall is really not going to solve the problem. And in addition, it's going to cost a lot of money. But of course, Trump says that, you know, the United States is not going to pay for the wall. It's going to be Mexico. And he's going to do that by imposing a tax. But in reality, that tax will then be imposed on us due to all the importing of Mexican goods into the United States. So in reality, Mexico will not be paying for the wall. Americans will be paying for the wall.
Okay.
It also orders for an additional hiring of 5,000 CBP agents and 500 Air and Marine agents. The thing is, it's a bit concerning because as of now, 60% of people who apply to be part of the Border Patrol actually fail the background check. So it's going to be really hard to actually fulfill the amount of Border Patrol agents that Trump seeks to hire. So what does that mean? They're probably going to become more lenient on how they allow allowing people to become Border Patrol agents, which is concerning on many levels, you know, national security levels, because people won't be passing background checks, as well as to, you know, humanitarian concerns as to how people will be treated once they cross into the United States. This executive order also has other ridiculous measures in it, including building detention centers in Mexico and Canada. How is he going to do that? I don't know. But what he wants to basically do is that when people present themselves into the border, instead of actually admitting them into the United States, they would be detained in either Mexico and Canada until they complete their immigration proceedings, or what's also considered known as port court, which they used to do before under the Bush administration, when basically people would come in and have like an expedited removal proceeding at the border before they're actually allowed in the United States. So some people wouldn't even make it past that, which is concerning too, because people don't have a right to attorneys at the border. So we don't know actually what happens or how these hearings are being adjudicated or if people's rights are actually being respected.
So at this moment, while he can't deport everybody and he's probably not going to deport everybody, he can terrorize everybody, mm-hmm. which is really what's going on. And he's irritating a lot of United States citizens who are perfectly legally allowed to be here and yet are having to fear for being harassed and being profiled, for mm-hmm. example. What steps can people take in this situation in those gray areas? They're undocumented, but they're contributing here in the United States. What are they facing right now?
Well, just some pieces of advice, and Alejandro, feel free to chime in. Keep doing what you're doing. You know, the best thing that you can do is keep obeying the law, filing your taxes. Do not stop doing that. Also, because that can potentially work to your benefit in the future, if you're able to actually attain a form of immigration relief. And also, I just wanted to touch on a quick point that you mentioned. Yes, immigrants contribute a ton to this nation. They pay taxes, they pay sales tax, you know, they're purchasing homes, they're creating businesses. And one of the biggest misconceptions is that immigrants abuse our public benefit system. What people don't know is that you actually don't have a right to any public benefit unless you have some sort of status, mostly that of a legal permanent resident or a U.S. citizen. So undocumented immigrants, they can't get welfare, they can't get cash aid. They can do so through their U.S. citizen children who have a right to that benefit, but they themselves do not derive that benefit. So when Donald Trump uses this rhetoric, it's infuriating, mostly because the public is under the misconception that they're here and they're basically leeching off our society, when in reality they're contributing a lot more than, in my opinion, some U.S. citizens even. And as to tips of what they can do to protect themselves now is be proactive. You know, even though you are undocumented, you still have rights, which Alejandro can talk about a little bit more. And also engage in your community, you know, voice your opinion, have your community members who do have status or are U.S. citizens call, you know, your local representative to vocalize how upset you are that ICE is either entering your community or, you know, how you want your city or your county to take a stance against Trump. And another thing that we're also recommending people who are undocumented is in one of these executive orders, Trump does expand something called expedited removal. So expedited removal would usually only happen at the border when a person enters and within the first 100 miles, if ICE catches, I mean, not ICE, ICE or CBP catches you, they can deport you then and there without your right to an attorney. These executive orders have now expedited removal throughout the United States. So anywhere within the interior of the United States. So basically anyone who's undocumented and can't prove they've been in the United States continuously for 2 years. So we are recommending that if you're undocumented, carry some sort of documentation that proves that you've been living in the United States these last 2 years. You can do that either through your, you know, records of your children, if you have U.S. citizen children, such as birth certificates. Also, you know, report cards, school records, medical records, or even your taxes, if your taxes have your ITIN number and not a fake Social Security number.
Okay, Alejandro, ground troops. Tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing recently.
Well, since the election, we've been getting a lot of demand for these Know Your Rights presentations. People want to know what they can do now, what they can do if ICE shows up to their house, employers, if they detain them on the street. So we've had a huge increase in demand for Know Your Rights presentations. In addition, during the election, there was a lot of interest in applying for citizenship. And we've actually seen that we expected after the election that interest to die down a little bit, but it's actually increased since the election results. And people are afraid because of the rhetoric that Trump's been throwing out. They're very afraid, so they're trying to take steps to protect themselves by becoming citizens. They have been hearing about situations where people at the border are not allowed to return, and then the executive orders with the banning of the people from the six Muslim countries, that made everybody even more fearful of even traveling outside the United States. So there's a huge interest, increasing interest in applying for citizenship right now to protect themselves.
Why would somebody not want to become a citizen? Why were they putting it off? Was it money or was it other reasons?
A lot of myths. That's a great question. One of the biggest reasons is the money. It is expensive, $725. But what people don't realize is that there's a pretty generous fee waiver, which will waive the whole fee. And now there's also a partial fee waiver that'll waive a part of the fee. And I would say 98% of our clients qualify for the fee waiver, so they get the entire fee waived. Another common thing that prohibits them from applying is people say, I don't know English, I'm going to fail this test. And what people don't realize is that if you're a lawful permanent resident for a certain amount of years and you're a certain age, you can take it in your own language. So you don't have to say a single word in English. So there's these great things that people don't know, which will make applying for naturalization much more accessible. And so we're half the battle is educating and informing the community on the availability of these resources and options.
Do people who have legal residence, are they susceptible to ICE?
Yeah, anybody who's a lawful, anybody who's not a U.S. citizen can be deportable if they commit a certain crime. It depends on what kind of crime. There's different categories, different consequences. But yes, if you're not a U.S. citizen and you get into trouble, you could potentially be deported no matter how much family you have here, no matter how long you've been here. So it's really important if you're eligible to become a citizen to try. And a lot of people say, I don't want to become a citizen. They're afraid that if they fail the test, they're going to get deported. But in actuality, if you fail your citizenship test, generally you just remain a lawful permanent resident. You can try again later, especially if you qualify for the fee waiver. It's free, and we do it for free. And there's a lot of nonprofits around now in LA that are hosting workshops every month, every 2 weeks at the Mexican consulate, huge citizenship workshops where they're processing citizenship applications for free.
Okay, if you're a legal resident, how long is the process if you pay your fee or you get reimbursed in some way, you get a fee waiver, how long is that process from applying to actually getting citizenship?
Well, the interview, because a lot of people are applying, they're taking about 5 to 7 months right now to give you the naturalization interview. And assuming you do pass and you get approved, then you usually get the ceremony in the ceremony date about a month after that. So when you do the oath and you show up and you actually get your certificate, that's the day that you're legally a citizen. So 6 to 8 months, I'd say.
And are people from Mexico in particular, are they able to maintain dual citizenship?
Yes, they're automatically dual citizens, so they automatically get the benefits of both countries. There's really no negative result from becoming a citizen. There are some countries that don't allow for dual citizenship. Off the top of my head, Chile, I think, is one. Honduras, I think, is another. Cuba. But generally, yeah, most countries do allow for automatic dual citizenship.
Are we seeing ICE agents aggressively going after communities that are not from Latin American countries, like from Europe or Canada, for example?
Not from what we've seen. It's been Muslim countries and Latinos that have been targeted.
They're mostly targeting urban communities, and they're also focusing on doing workplace raids. And we've been seeing that, coincidentally, ICE has been targeting cities that have been the most vocal against Trump and have been declaring themselves to either be sanctuary cities or saying we're not going to respect detainers or whatever it may be. So some of these raids have actually been taking places in Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, for example. And majority of the time, sometimes these raids also get unreported because people who are picked up are subsequently deported or are too afraid to come forward. For example, we had an incident at the church that we served, Dolores Mission Parish, where a family member of of a kid that goes to the school was picked up and was subsequently let go, but she was fearful that, you know, if she released this information, ICE would retaliate against her.
Okay, let's say an ICE agent comes to your house, knocks on the door. What do you do?
First step is you need to identify who's on the other side of that door. So you need to ask them, who is that? What's your name? What agency are you from? What we've been hearing is that they are stating that they are police. And it's not, although misleading, it's unfortunately not illegal for them to say that. They are a federal law enforcement officer. So that's what they've been doing. They've been taking advantage of the word police so that people think that it's not ICE. But there's some things that they can do at that point to try and figure out if it's a police officer or if it's an ICE officer, Immigration Customs Enforcement officer. One of the biggest indications is the uniform. Cops, they'll show up in cop uniform, the classic cop uniform. ICE officers tend to show up in like jeans, like a vest, like a jacket. Also look to see how they arrived. Cops are going to show up in a cop car, classic black and white. Whereas ICE, they tend to show up in vans, and generally it does say, you know, an indication that it is ICE. And finally, we actually got this really great advice from the captain, a captain at LAPD. He said, if you're trying to figure out if cops are on the other side of the door, call 911. Say, hey, there's somebody at my door. They're telling me that they're cops. Like, do you know? Can you tell me if they are, in fact, officers? And then they should be able to tell you, yes, we sent, you know, this unit's here, or no, we have no idea who's at your door. So once you figure out who it is, definitely don't open the door. This should all, I should have mentioned that before. Don't open the door. This should all be communication just through the door with the door closed. If you open the door, they can interpret that as an invitation to come in. Once they're in, it's going to be hard to get them out. So definitely don't open the door. Figure out who's on the other side of that door. If it is ICE, they need a warrant for them to enter your home. So you need to ask them, do you have a warrant? If they say yes, which usually they will say yes, you have to see that warrant. So have them slide it under the door or even give it to you through a window. Now, you also have to make sure that it's a search warrant. There's two different types of warrants: search warrant, which does allow them to come onto the premises, and there's also an arrest warrant, which simply allows them to just arrest the person, not enter your home. So ideally, you know, you'd have somebody who speaks English, can read the warrant, make sure that it says allowed to search premises. And then if they do have a warrant and the person is home and they do have a warrant to enter the premises, then you really have to make a tough decision as to whether it's in the best interest of everybody in the home for the person to just present themselves. What we've been seeing is if they allow ICE to enter the home and there's other people that are undocumented in the home, ICE will enter, detain everybody while they search for that person that they came to find. In the process, they'll ask other family members questions, figure out that maybe other people are undocumented, and in the process end up detaining more than just the individual that they were looking for. So it might be best to take some steps to protect other undocumented people in the home by just, you know, presenting yourself if they do have a valid search and arrest warrant.
Let's say they don't have a search warrant, they just have an arrest warrant. What do you recommend they do?
Don't open the door. Tell them, I know you don't have a right to enter these premises, and the interaction should end there. Ignore them. It's going to be very difficult. A lot of people are very afraid to assert their rights, and it is scary. There's an authority there. ICE is very used to doing whatever they want. I love telling the story that our colleague Sandra Ruiz, another staff attorney at the clinic, told me. She was talking to one of the directors of ICE, and she's like, hey, you know, so how do you go about getting these search warrants that you need to enter these homes? And he's like, what are you talking about? She's like, yeah, the search warrant that you need to enter. And he's like, we don't need no warrant. We enter. And so they're used to really doing whatever they want. I mean, people are really afraid to say no. So it's really important now more than ever to inform people about their rights and to make sure that people are empowered to assert those rights when needed.
Man, this is great stuff. Okay, let's say you're in your car. What do you do in that case? You're out of your home.
Out of your home is more difficult. At that point, the first step would ask, am I being detained or arrested? Am I free to leave? And if they say you are being detained or you are being arrested, you're not free to leave, at that point I would remind people of the three biggest, most important points. One is the right to remain silent. Second is the right to ask for an attorney. And the third is the right to refuse to sign anything until you are able to speak to an attorney. So at that point, if you are undocumented, you are approached, and you ask them, am I detained? Am I free to leave? And they do say no, you are detained or you are arrested. it would be in your best interest to remain silent. The government has the burden to prove certain things: your home country, when you entered, when you entered, where you entered. And if you definitely don't want to make their job any easier. So if you don't give them any of that information, it's going to take them time to figure that stuff out. In that time, you can contact family members, attorneys, and try and get somebody there to help you out while they try and figure those things out.
And ICE will actually do that. There was an incident in when there was raids in East Los Angeles where an ICE agent, or was it a van, stopped people who were driving. Sandra told the story. And so basically, an ICE agent stopped a car and asked the two people in the car, which one of you guys have a DUI? And they freely gave that information. It turned out it was the passenger, so the ICE agent took the passenger.
And they were basically just fishing at that point. They're like, well, and that's what they do a lot of the time when they show up to the metro courthouses and they ask people random questions. They're just seeing who's going to freely, voluntarily offer up incriminating information about their immigration status.
And yet we have to remind people that you don't have to answer those questions. You're not required to.
Okay, at what point can ICE agents refuse to give you representation from an attorney, call loved ones, or restrict your rights in any other way?
Well, everybody has a right. They'll have a right to make a call, and they'll also have a right. Everybody has a right to contact their consulate. So the federal government, ICE, has an obligation to notify the consulate of your home country if you're being detained, which will give the consulate, generally the consulate will make an attempt to go see you and connect you to some sort of legal help if they can. But it does get more difficult when there are people who have been deported before or people who are subject to the expedited removal, which Marissa mentioned. That allows them to remove them in an expedited manner. So in that situation, it's a fight against time. An attorney's trying to do their best to get there as quickly as possible to file a motion for stay on the so they don't reinstate the deportation order. So it really is just a fight against time, which is why it's so crucial that you give them the least amount of information possible, so it gives us the most amount of time possible to help them out.
And then just to add is that ICE can't refuse you the right to see an attorney, but they don't have to provide you an attorney. Unlike criminal proceedings and immigration proceedings, you don't have a right to counsel unless you're able to provide for your own counsel. So we are recommending people that, even though we know finances are tight, if you're really nervous about being picked up, have an attorney on hand, sign a retainer. So if you know that that incident ends up happening, there is someone you can call. And then just to differentiate a little bit is, you do have a right for an attorney within the interior of the United States, but you don't at the border. So that's what we were seeing a lot with the Muslim ban too, is that when people were entering, CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, were denying them the right to see an attorney, and were denying attorneys who were willing to volunteer to actually enter and provide them legal services. It's because technically when you're at the border, you have not been admitted into the United States, so then your constitutional rights don't necessarily always apply to you. Hence, they can tell you, hey, tough luck, no attorney for you.
Can you let our listeners know about some of your experiences going to El Paso?
This last spring break, and Alejandro was with me, we led an alternative spring break to El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And the reason why we decided to do this, especially during a time like now, is that we ended up realizing that we had to teach our students that being an immigration attorney is not limited to what you can do here in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, we're truly in a bubble that's very progressive when it comes to immigrant rights work. So we decided to take them to somewhere else where it's a little bit more challenging. And it wanted to expose students to what does it mean to be an attorney at the border. So even though El Paso is considered to be a liberal city within the city of Texas, you know, immigration law and the way that it's practiced and adjudicated is a lot tougher than here in LA because it's in the Fifth Circuit versus the Ninth Circuit. So while we were there, we represented 21 individuals in immigration proceedings along with our partners at UNO. We also did a border patrol tour. We actually went into Juarez and visited the consulate and also get to see an actual criminal proceedings in a Mexican court. But the whole point was to really show students as to how versatile they can be as attorneys, and then how much impact you can make actually going and volunteering your time or deciding to dedicate yourself to doing immigrant rights work at the border.
You actually put your legal talents to work on the border. Tell us about some of these cases.
Well,
Alejandro
actually got to represent some of those people.
Yes, well, we got to appear before Immigration Judge Howe, and he was very accommodating. He calendared all these cases within a three-day span to allow us to come and represent these people in court, which was great. He obviously didn't have to do that. And
well, how did you approach him, just letting him know that you were there in the first place? Like, we're here. We want to start doing... How did that whole... Tell us how you set that up.
I believe he approached my boss, actually.
Go ahead.
He did. I was actually the... spring break before that, I went to El Paso because I was curious to see border issues. And I met with him there. And he was actually one that approached me and told us, hey, you know what? There's no law school here or that's near El Paso or even New Mexico that's willing to come and provide services. It would be great if we can coordinate an alternative spring break program so you guys can come here since so many people, you know, who come before me are unrepresented. So it was kind of the stars just aligned and it worked out, and we were able to find another nonprofit in the area too, UNO, which is led by Jose Moreno.
What does UNO stand for?
The United Neighborhood Organization, to help us coordinate and, you know, get cases where the students were able to appear. And it was great too because we were able to see the differences between, for example, Texas criminal law and how it impacts immigration proceedings versus California criminal law and how it impacts immigration proceedings. And we were also able to see like how it differed in the sense of like what do judges want in El Paso that differs from judges here in Los Angeles. For example, when it came to adjustment of status or getting your green card before the court in El Paso, you were required to prove that you were paying taxes, which here in LA is not necessarily always the case.
And then also they required 40 hours of community service, which is something that they don't always require in Los Angeles.
But this is also because a lot of these forms of relief in front of immigration court are discretionary. So it's up to the judge to decide what factors he or she wants to consider in granting someone legal permanent residency in the United States.
Okay, now if somebody finds out that this judge is not hardline enough, does he get removed? Does he get voted in? Can Trump fire him?
I don't think Trump can go and fire him. It's actually a pretty competitive application process, and he actually had explained it to us before, but I don't recall. And they do have a response, like, you know, a lead judge who is in charge of all of them and can, you know, review their work. And also the thing is, when you're an attorney, be ICE counsel or the immigration attorney, you also have a right to an appeal. So even though you might not like your judge, you can still very much appeal and contest his decision before the Board of Immigration Appeals.
To be clear, he's not the most lenient judge. He definitely didn't take it very easy on us. I got grilled about some taxes. And so he's definitely, I thought, a very reasonable judge. Yeah, I didn't think he was, you know, the easiest judge we've seen. I thought he was very fair and reasonable in his request. And his main interest was educating students and giving them an invaluable experience. So, yeah, it was great.
Okay, let's go back to some of these individual cases. Who were you representing at this time, and what types of issues did you have to present and deal with?
El Paso or here?
El Paso.
El Paso, I was able to represent some clients in, they were applying for their green card in court, so they were in removal proceedings, they were trying to deport them, but they were actually eligible for a green card because they were married to a U.S. citizen spouse. So in one of my cases, I had to basically just present what our plan was going to be. So the first step usually is called the master calendar. That's when you tell the judge, this is what I'm going to apply for. And usually they'll set out another date. Where you'll have to turn some stuff in, and then you can really present your case. And then I also got to do an individual hearing, which is where you actually present your case. So at that point, you usually have to allow the client to testify about hardships that he would endure if he were to get deported, and also about how awesome he is, how he stayed out of trouble, and what he does for his family. And then you usually also have to put the U.S. citizen spouse on the stand, so elicit some testimony from them about how much their spouse does for them and things of that nature. So it was a really good experience for everybody. You know, you do have to question your clients in front of a judge. Everything's on the record, and show the judge why this person deserves a green card. Because at the end of the day, like my boss said, it is discretionary whether the judge does grant the green card or not.
You have been listening to a discussion with Marisa Montes, co-director of the Loyola Law School Immigrant Justice Clinic, and Alejandro Barajas, one of their staff attorneys. To find out more, you can call them at 213-736-1317 or email them at lijc@lls.edu. They offer free advice and in Los Angeles offer free consultations twice per week by appointment. If you would like a copy of this program, you can call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go to our website, www.pacificaradioarchives.org. You've been listening to From the Vault. I'm Mark Torres. Thank you for helping keep our history alive.
Listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.